It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
the landlord would conduct the same inspection, sign off on it, then the landlord would go back to their office and compare the results of the move-out inspection with the move-in inspection. If there are any damages that are attributable to the tenant, then the landlord would make a report indicating what deductions are made from the security deposit and send back any remaining security deposit or all of the security deposit and the report to the tenant within 45 days.
Private attorney Linda Price discusses security deposits, what they can and cannot be used for, and the rights of both the landlord and the tenant when there's a damage dispute. And during this week's question and answer, we learn how the minimum wage laws affect tipped employees and why they are entitled to at least $7.25 per hour, no matter what. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 61, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. The 1st of July is an important date for people with federal student loans. It's when interest rates and other terms change each year. On July 1, 2009, income-based repayment became available for the first time. Income-based repayment, or IBR, can make your loan payments more affordable by capping your monthly payments based on your income and family size. The program covers almost all federal loans made to undergraduate and graduate students, past, present, or future, including both direct loans and federal loans from a private lender like Sallie Mae or Citibank. And any debt and interest remaining after 25 years of payments will be forgiven. In addition, if you work in a government, nonprofit, or other public service job, your federal student loans could be forgiven in as few as 10 years of IBR or other qualifying payments. More information is available at www.ibrinfo.org. In other news, abused and battered women from other nations will find less resistance on the path toward starting their lives over by coming to the United States. A recent court case shows the Obama administration is reversing Bush-era positions that had made it nearly impossible for abused women to gain asylum here. Under prior policy, an applicant for asylum had to demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution because of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group, but that did not include being an abused or battered woman. However, even under the policy change, women seeking asylum still will have to meet strict guidelines. They must show that, in their home country, they are treated as if they are property, that domestic abuse is widely tolerated, and that they could not find protection through local institutions or by moving to a different area of their country. The policy change became apparent in a U.S. Department of Justice filing in an asylum case in San Francisco. Information about Virginia's Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance can be found online at www.vadv.org. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's legal term of the week is 30-day notice to vacate. A 30-day notice to vacate is a written notice your landlord must give you if your landlord wants to evict you for any reason other than not paying rent. The written notice asks you to move in 30 days. If you don't move in 30 days, your landlord can start an eviction action in general district court. This is also called an unlawful detainer action. You don't have to move just because your landlord gives you a 30-day notice to vacate. Your landlord must wait until after a court order has been issued. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and 30-day notice to vacate is this week's legal term of the week.
It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Tell us your name and where you're from.
My name is Christy Newman, and I am from West End, Richmond.
Thank you for being on the show. What question do we have this week?
My question is, if a waitress is not making more than minimum wage on her tips, would she get recompensated on her 213 pay?
Let me see if I understand the question. You were being paid 213 an hour plus the tips?
Yes, sir. I was getting paid 213 an hour plus tips, yet sometimes I was not averaging that to be minimum wage per hour.
And so your question is whether the employer has to pay you at least the minimum wage in that situation?
Yes, that is my question. If I do not make minimum wage per hour, is the employer required to compensate me?
Well, the answer to the question is a very simple yes. In other words, the minimum wage for most workers is now $7.25 an hour. Until July 24, it was $6.55 an hour. And that applies to almost everybody who works in this country. Now, tipped employees are allowed to be paid $2.13 per hour plus the tips, and you must be allowed to keep the tips that you receive, although there are certain pooled or shared tips rules that are permitted. But regardless of how much you're getting in tips, whether it's individual tips or shared or pooled tips, if the tips plus the $2.13 an hour don't equal minimum wage, your employer has to pay you at least the minimum wage and supplement your pay up to that $7.25 an hour. In other words, you shouldn't be working, let's say, 20 hours a week and coming home with a paycheck of $60, $70, $80 a week. You have to get at least the minimum wage. Now, if you don't get at least the minimum wage, you need to bring that to the attention of the wage and hour division of the U.S. Department of Labor. They are the ones who enforce the minimum wage laws, and there's an office for them that's right here in Richmond. They're located at 400 North 8th Street, room 418, and they have a toll-free number. It's 1-866-487-9243. Now, there are time deadlines to file those wage claims with the Department of Labor. I think the time deadline is at least 1 year. So if you weren't paid minimum wage, you got cheated out of money you earned. Simple as that. And you should file a wage claim with the Wage and Hour Division of the U.S. Department of Labor. Is that something that you see in your future?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being on the show. We're here at the Carytown Law Office talking with Linda Price. She is an attorney who does landlord-tenant law. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you, Marty. Happy to be here today.
We're going to be talking today about the law of security deposits. So we should start with the basic concept. Linda, what is a security deposit?
Well, a security deposit is a sum of money that a landlord generally takes when a tenant signs the lease. And it is a refundable source of money that the landlord will use if needed, either during the lease or at the end of the lease.
Let's start at the beginning of the tenancy. What happens right when a tenant moves in and pays the security deposit to determine the condition of the premises?
Generally, when a tenant moves into a property, the landlord gives the tenant a list. It's generally called a move-in inspection list. And the tenant has 5 days after they receive that list to go through the property and make notes of any items that may need repair or anything that's wrong with the property. And that determines the condition of the property at the time of move-in.
And what would happen if the landlord doesn't give that report or inspection list to the tenant? What would you advise the tenant at that point to do?
If the tenant does not receive that report, it's really to the tenant's benefit to make a list themselves and to give that list to the landlord showing the condition of the property at that time.
And what about taking photographs? Would a tenant be well advised to do something like that also?
Photographs are always a good idea. A picture speaks 1,000 words.
Okay, so after the inspection report has been done, whether it's been done by the tenant after getting it from the landlord or the tenant does it on the tenant's own behalf, what happens if something needs repair or something is the tenant's fault? What are the tenant's rights here? What are the landlord's rights here?
Well, there are different requirements if this is during the course of the lease. Most landlords have a procedure for a tenant to report any items that need repair during the course of the lease. The tenant should follow that procedure. It generally requires something be put in writing. Emails now are an excellent way to keep up with requests to the landlord for repairs.
And emails are considered sufficient writing to notify the landlord of the need for repairs?
Yes.
Now, what if the landlord believes that the tenant is at fault for a particular condition, repair, maintenance? What's the landlord supposed to do to notify the tenant about that and to possibly make a deduction from the security deposit?
The landlord should go into the property, make the repair, and if he determines that it's the tenant's fault, the landlord has the option during the course of the tenancy to actually use the security deposit to make the repair and provide the tenant with notification that he's done so within 30 days of the time that he's made that deduction. So the landlord, during the course of the tenancy, may use the money and must provide a 30-day notice that he's used the security deposit.
Now, what if the tenant receives that notice from the landlord and disagrees and thinks, well, this wasn't my fault and this should have been covered as part of routine maintenance. Does the tenant have any recourse there?
The tenant may have recourse through the filing of a tenant's assertion to determine whether the security deposit should have been used for that purpose.
And so how would a tenant go about filing a tenant's assertion in that case?
The tenant should send the landlord a letter indicating what the complaint is and giving the landlord time to remedy the complaint. If the landlord doesn't remedy the complaint to the satisfaction of the tenant, then the tenant should pay their money to the court, the next month's rent, to the court's escrow, and let the judge decide the matter.
Well, Linda, we've spoken about what the landlord can and cannot do during the course of the tenancy with the security deposit. What is supposed to happen when the tenant moves out or announces an intention to move out?
Once the tenant gives an intention to move out in writing to the landlord should respond to the tenant. I always advise either accepting that letter as a proper intent to move out or not. And if it is a proper intent to move out, the landlord should confirm the date and advise the tenant that the tenant has the right to be present at a move-out inspection.
And when is that move-out inspection supposed to take place?
It's supposed to take place within 72 hours of the time that the landlord actually receives possession back of the premises. So the return of the keys.
And that was my next question that you anticipated. What constitutes return of possession? I assume that means the place is essentially broom clean and those all-important keys have been turned over to the landlord?
And the keys have been turned into the landlord. Without that, really, the landlord does not know that the tenant has moved out. Many times a tenant could give a move-out date, circumstances arise, and the tenant has not moved out. The landlord should really receive the keys before they go back to the premises. And I just want to say also that the tenant, once they receive notification from the landlord that they have the right to be present at a move-out inspection, the tenant needs to notify the landlord in writing that they intend to be present at the inspection.
Okay, so let's talk about both scenarios now. The landlord and the tenant are both there at the move-out inspection that is taking place now 72 hours or less after the keys have been turned in, the tenant's been vacated. Walk us through the process. What's supposed to happen?
Generally, the landlord and the tenant should walk through the premises and use a form similar to that move-in inspection form. I always suggest that the landlord not use that exact form because I don't want the landlord to be prejudiced one way or the other as to the condition of the property at move-in. But he should use a similar form, and the two of them complete together any damages that they've found at the premises at that time. And the law requires that the landlord and the tenant sign off on that form.
Now, would you advise a tenant also to bring a camera to that move-out inspection? Again, you said before, a picture's worth 1,000 words. Is that a good thing to do at that point as well?
Yes, and it's a good thing for the landlord to do as well.
So both parties are there, both parties have cameras. Hopefully they can agree on things and resolve the matter. What happens if the landlord is present and the tenant is not? What are the landlord's obligations here?
The landlord would conduct the same inspection, sign off on it, then the landlord would go back to their office and compare the results of the move-out inspection with the move-in inspection. If there are any damages that are attributable to the tenant, then the landlord would make a report indicating what deductions are made from the security deposit, and send back any remaining security deposit or all of the security deposit and the report to the tenant within 45 days.
Well, that again anticipating my next question. So really, the tenant is not going to get that security deposit back for as long as 45 days. So I guess they have to come up with additional monies to have a new security deposit for a new place.
Absolutely. The law is clear on that 45 days. In addition, the law tells the landlord that if the landlord has to hire a contractor, he has an additional 15 days to return the security deposit or to make that report to the tenant. So it could be as much as 60 days.
So in other words, if the tenant has not received either the security deposit refunded or that itemized list of damages or something, some combination within 45 days, I guess it could be as late as 60 days if they had to hire a contractor.
Yes. Another thing I'd like to say also, Marty, is that often the landlord runs into the problem where they're unable to contact the tenant. So when the tenant gives that initial notice to vacate the property, the tenant should really provide a good address for the landlord to keep in touch with the tenant.
And even if the tenant doesn't know at the time of notice to vacate, where they're moving to. As soon as they do, they should, what, provide a forwarding address?
They should provide a forwarding address, or if they would like any notifications to be sent to family members where they can receive that notification, that's really a good idea. I often find that my clients are eager to return security deposits that have been sitting in escrow accounts, and they don't have addresses to return those deposits.
So as many possible addresses as is reasonable would probably be good advice for tenants to give.
Yes.
Now, a lot of tenants believe or try to use the security deposit for the last month's rent. What's the law on that? What can the tenant do in that situation?
Well, the law again states in the Landlord-Tenant Act that the rent, even the last month's rent, is not to be offset by the security deposit. The tenant should pay all of the rent under the lease as called for, even in the last month.
Now, what happens in a situation where the landlord doesn't do what the law requires, that is, within the 45 or even 60-day period, doesn't return the security deposit, doesn't send the itemized list of damages, there's just no response at all? What are the tenant's remedies at that point?
The Landlord-Tenant Act provides a good remedy to the tenant. The tenant has the absolute right to request that security deposit with interest and any damages they've suffered from the landlord. And as a matter of fact, the tenant may also recover their attorney's fees if the landlord has willfully, wrongfully withheld that security deposit.
What would be considered something that the landlord could withhold part or all of the security deposit, as opposed to things that the landlord couldn't withhold part or all of the security deposit for?
The landlord should not charge the tenant for items that are damaged by normal wear and tear. There's a difference between a carpet that's damaged just by walking on it repeatedly. That's normal wear and tear versus a carpet that's damaged by spilling Kool-Aid or pet urine, cigarette burns on a carpet. Both of those carpets are damaged to some degree. One, by merely walking on it, that's normal wear of a carpet, versus a cigarette burn or Kool-Aid spills, that's beyond normal wear and tear.
And I assume that same process would go through other things in the apartment or the dwelling, whether it's the walls or the appliances or something like that. It's sort of a case by case. What's normal, what should be expected, as opposed to, you know, what's unusual.
Yes, and generally, if the landlord will charge for something, for example, repainting of walls, that's always a hot topic. And sometimes we'll see that painters will put down, well, on one wall, we had two or three nail holes. That's normal. And on another wall, we had 50 nail holes. That's beyond normal wear and tear. But sometimes even reasonable people can disagree on what's normal wear and tear.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with Linda Price. She is an attorney doing landlord-tenant law at the Carytown Law Office, 20 South Auburn Street, just north of Carey Street. Thank you so much for being on the show, Linda.
Thank you for having me.
This week's top three tips are about writ of possession. The first tip is that a writ of possession is the court form that allows the sheriff to evict a tenant. Only a law enforcement officer can make you leave or put you and your belongings out. Your landlord can't make you leave or put you and your belongings out. The second tip is that the sheriff must take the writ of possession to your home. The writ must say the date and time when you will be evicted and give you at least 72 hours advance written notice. The third tip is that paying your landlord in full after the judgment or writ of possession does not keep you from being evicted. As long as your landlord gives you proper written notice accepting your rent with reservation. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King. And for this week, that's our top three tips about writ of possession.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. Also, if you have a question you would like answered or any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. Please include your name and phone number. You also can leave that same information before 8 a.m. or after 6 p.m. by calling 200-6045. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Housing discrimination is not a relic from the 1960s. It exists in Richmond and it happens every day. Tune in next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when our guest, attorney Susan Scovel, talks about housing discrimination, its various forms, and what to do about it in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on August 20th, 2008. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbrecht.